Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, Ann Arbor Elections, Exploring Options. We want to thank the Ann Arbor District Library for hosting us this evening, and we want to thank our panelists for sharing their expertise with us. And of course, we want to thank all of you, the audience, for participating in this important discussion about our local elections, how well they're working, and what changes, if any, we might want to make. So why is the League bringing this topic to the community? Our motivation springs directly from our core mission, which is to empower voters to exercise their right to vote, to foster civil dialogue about community issues, and to advocate for positive change. We believe that holding a civil dialogue about whether our local system of elections is encouraging citizens to exercise their right to vote is an important discussion that we should have. To that end, we've planned a three-part exploration of this topic. We began on March 3rd in this room with former Mayor Lou Belcher, former City Councilwoman Jean Carlberg, and former editor of the Ann Arbor Chronicle, Dave Askins, sharing with us their experiences within the Ann Arbor election system, discussing what worked well and what didn't work so well. If you're interested in hearing that discussion, there's a link to the program available on the library's website. Tonight, we're taking the next step. We have invited three different panelists to help us explore what other communities around the country may have tried, what kind of changes we're even allowed to make according to Michigan law, and whether any changes would make a significant difference in citizen participation. This program will be followed by a more interactive session sometime next fall. We'll begin the evening's program by listening to our panelists discuss a series of questions designed to bring out areas of concern such as partisanship, voter turnout, and our current ward system. Following the panel, you will have the opportunity to ask questions or make comments. You may write your question or comment on a card, or you may go to the microphone. We'll be limiting your question or comment time to 2 minutes, and no one will be allowed to make a second comment until everyone who wants to speak has been heard. So let us begin tonight's discussion. League member Judy Mitch will serve as tonight's moderator. Judy?
Okay. Thank you, Miriam. Welcome and thank each of you for your interest in considering Ann Arbor election reform. As Miriam has said, this is the League's second forum on the issue. Before, on March the 3rd, we had a panel of local practitioners, a former mayor, a former councilwoman, and a journalist. They first examined the questions. Now we've invited a panel of local professional experts on the subject. All of these gentlemen live in Ann Arbor, and I'd like to introduce them to you. To my immediate left is John R. Chamberlain, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Michigan's Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. Excuse me. John's PhD is from Stanford, and listed among his professional interests are the study and teaching of ethics, public policy, methods of election, and legislative redistricting. Next, to my far left, and our Democrat on the panel, or our declared Democrat on the panel, shall we say, is Lawrence Kestenbaum. He's the current Washtenaw County Clerk and Register of Deeds. He received his Juris Doctor from Wayne State University and has served as an elected official in both Ingham and Washtenaw counties. Larry is a member of the Democratic Party and counts among his many interests politics, demography, and local history. And rounding it out, but in the middle here, we have Joseph Oren, presently professor of political science in the College of Arts and Sciences at Eastern Michigan University. There he teaches courses in public administration and policy. Joe earned his PhD at Syracuse University and has worked with the Michigan Municipal League as well as many local nonprofits. I think you've heard this already, but we'll do it again. The agenda for this program begins with the panelists answering questions previously drawn up, and they're familiar with them. In fact, they helped draw them up. Each member will be limited to about 3 minutes with hopefully some points of interaction. They're already telling me they can't do it in 3 minutes, but we'll see. We have 5 questions to consider in 50 minutes. Beyond these prepared questions, we'll welcome your questions from the audience. And as Miriam and Jenny have both said, you can do it either by a written question or to come to the microphone when the time permits. We'll be trying to alternate mic and written questions just to keep it efficient, but we'll see how well we do. Anyhow, we'll work on that. These questions, notice I didn't say statements, will be limited to 2 minutes each. So here we go. We're going to start with the prepared questions, followed by your audience questions, both written and at the mic, and we'll go to about 8:30 p.m. So here we are. Let's get going. Question number one, and my orders say I must start with Larry Kestenbaum. I'm not sure if you requested that or you were ordered to, but begin with Larry. It says, what limitations do municipalities face in determining matters related to elections, such as election dates, rules for primaries, early voting opportunities, absentee ballot use, and so forth? I think that's for our lawyer. Okay, Larry.
All right.
Start with you.
Thank you, and good evening. Thank you all for being here. The Michigan election law prescribes many of the things you've just mentioned, including voting systems, election scheduling, absentee ballots, form of ballots, to a much greater extent than in the past. Those of us who have been around for a while can remember a lot of different variations in the way that elections were conducted in different places, in different parts of the state, in different levels. Particularly since the election consolidation law that went into effect in 2005, election authority has been consolidated to a very large extent. For example, Ann Arbor's elections used to be held in April of every year. This was a very common, in fact, this was the typical schedule for city and township elections. Township elections were held in the first Monday in April in both even and odd years until 1943. And Ann Arbor, and there was also a statewide election in April. And Ann Arbor was one of the few places that continued the April election tradition until we had a voter initiative to change those elections from April to November. Well, April is no longer an option. Had that initiative not been done, we would have ended up with November elections by default through the state has limited the election dates to February, May, August, and November, and further limits how those election dates may be used. The February date is now being there's talk of eliminating it. When we talk about changing the schedule of elections in Ann Arbor, that's not up for the elections pretty much have to be in November and the primaries in August. When we think about different voting systems, whether approval voting or IRV or whatever, again, those would have to be authorized by state law. Right now, those are not options that are available. The ballots are prescribed, all those kinds of things.
Okay. Gentlemen, who can hardly wait to talk about that?
Well, let me just add one other thing. It's not only the timing of the elections, the kind of elections, and so on, but the nature of the qualified voter file is also a problem in terms of thinking about voter turnout, and that too is controlled by the state. It's difficult, if not impossible, to remove a registered voter from that file, and so you end up with a lot more names on that registration list than there are actual voters. So what we discover, of course, is that when you think about voter turnout, you can't really count the number of people who voted divided by the number of people on that registration list, because mm-hmm. the registration list is far greater. When people die or when people move, they're not automatically removed from that qualified voter file.
Well, they are, but it's not
in a timely fashion. So,
well, if a Washtenaw County resident dies in Washtenaw County, they will be their voter registration will be removed relatively promptly within a month. However, if a Washtenaw County resident dies someplace else, especially out of state, then there's no telling.
Right. Can you give any indication at all of the proportion of names on that registration list that are not real, that are not really potential voters?
That are no longer in the area, let's
right.
say, or are no longer living. The thing is that it varies from one area to another depending on what local units do have the ability to send out waves of mail and attempt to put voters on what's called the countdown clock, which they're given another couple of elections to, and some places have done that quite aggressively and others have not. So it really varies from one place to another, mm-hmm. even varies within a city according to, you know, depending on whether they've done
changes. Okay. Are there
changes.
Other issues or things, Joe or John, that you would want to?
No, but I think the list of problems that we can't fix locally is pretty much the list of the real problems that we face. I mean, the August primary is a disaster in terms of turnout. We can't do anything about that. The Republican Party has pretty much disappeared from city elections, which means that the November elections are kind of a yawn, which means that the August primary really matters, and the turnout there is woefully low. We had an awful lot of candidates for mayor in the recent primary. Using plurality voting to pick somebody with a winner when there are four candidates is a notoriously bad system to do that. We can't really modify that. We're stuck with you got to vote between, you know, 7 and 7 on Tuesday. Lots of states have much more, you know, lenient, generous, effective ways to increase turnout. And we've lost our principal ways of having community conversations about what's happening in the political arena. I mean, the Ann Arbor Chronicle has been shuttered, and the Ann Arbor News has been downgraded to the point where it doesn't do much. And so political discussion in town is not what it used to be. And we can't do much about any of that except wish things would get better. And Lansing has us by the throat on 3 of the 4.
So things like early voting and stuff, there is nothing that's a strictly state. And that would have to go through state procedures. We'd have to have an initiative.
Through a legislature that hasn't shown itself dedicated to maximizing turnout.
Okay. Now, Larry, go ahead.
The thing with early voting, many states have early voting for a period of a week or 2 weeks or something like that before the election, where they will open up in effect, precincts or super precincts for people to come and vote, and they have ballots prepared for them, and they can you know vote their ballot and put it in the tabulator and be done. The trouble with Michigan is that Michigan and Wisconsin and New England are the only states where elections are so radically decentralized that any system you think of for conducting an election has to take account of the fact that we have 1,500 townships, many of which have you know maybe two or 300 people or less, and there's no way that a system that would work for Detroit or Farmington Hills or Ann Arbor would work in Point of Bark Township, and so some kind of deal has to be worked out to make that work in every part of the state, and that has not been done. And that would be work. That would be a lot of work.
And what about, we haven't touched on the absentee ballot use. Is that state control as well? What about all people voting absentee?
Absolutely. The thing with absentee ballots is that we have the system that we have where, first of all, when you apply for an absentee ballot, you have to swear to a reason that you need your absentee ballot. You don't, you know, most clerks, I would say almost all of the local and county clerks in the state don't see any reason for this. If you wanted to vote absentee, you should be able to vote absentee. But under the current system, you still have to say you're going to be out of the community on election day or something of that nature.
Or old.
Or over 60, right. And then each absentee ballot is packaged up separately in an envelope, you know, signatures and so forth. It's a lot of paperwork per vote. And the and there's really no way around that. So people will come. For example, in the 2012 presidential election, there was a two-hour line at Ann Arbor City Hall for people wanting to vote absentee ahead of the election. But this was generates a lot of paperwork. It's not really the same thing as early voting.
Okay. I think I'll move on to question number two here. Ann Arbor is one of only three municipalities in the state of Michigan that has partisan city elections. What are the advantages and disadvantages of holding partisan or the nonpartisan elections? In other words, give us both sides. John, you ready to take that on?
Yeah, I'll take that on. Since the University of Michigan Political Science Department and the Institute for Social Research and the Center for Political Studies are famous for basically saying voter ID is what drives most voting behavior, and identification with a party is a principal signal that people use to decide which candidate am I inclined to vote for, and then follow that up with further information. Most cities aren't partisan, don't have partisan elections. I'm inclined to think that partisanship is not a problem, at least in Ann Arbor, with the exception of the fact that Republicans don't seem to want to run for office in Ann Arbor because the label is not something they wish to have tagged to their name these days. But I think that in the end, the fundamental decisions that city councils and mayors make are political decisions. The answers aren't in the back of some scientific management book of how much of this should we do, what should tax rates be. They're political decisions. And politics is driven by people's partisan ideologies, inclinations, sense of what are the main principles that incline them one way or another when it comes to politics. So it's the sort of lens through which almost everybody views politics. And to take that lens away, for the most part, these people grasping for what do these other symbols mean? Everybody's for apple pie and more police and
green
like fires and like the trash to be picked up on time and other kind of code words that are actually quite hard to decipher. The way they're quite hard to decipher now that we're all Democrats and you have to listen to, so what a neighborhood means and what does downtown mean and a bunch of other things that we're not quite sure and we're not used to doing it. So I think absent party, people will look for other signals, and they'll use race, ethnicity, Irish last names if you're running for judge, those kinds of things. And you think about voting for judges. We have no idea, for the most part, who we're voting for, because everybody's for the Constitution, due process, and rule of law. So you call up your lawyer friends and say, who should I vote for? Well, nonpartisan elections will have some of that kind of flavor. People won't be so restricted to pretending that they can't talk about substance. But I think that nonpartisanship isn't going to constrain decisions once people are elected. There's still going to be political philosophies playing out in a city council. There ought to be political philosophies playing out in city council. And I think government works just fine when we know what people's political philosophies are. And the best indicator we have of that is partisanship. So I think I'm singing the same tune that Gene Carlberg was singing. The first one, I think it's a good tune.
Gene is with us this evening, sitting there. Thank you for coming and for before. Once again, we're talking about the pros and cons, the advantages, disadvantages of partisan or nonpartisan elections. And just for the record, I didn't know. I knew it was Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, but it is the city of Ionia is the third municipality, as we're calling them, city that uses nonpartisan. How about Joe on this, pros and cons, your thoughts?
Well, I'd piggyback on a couple of John's comments. There is some empirical evidence to suggest that voter turnout is higher in partisan elections as opposed to nonpartisan elections. So if the goal is to increase turnout, going to a nonpartisan voting system may be problematic. Parties also serve a variety of other purposes, and I think it's important to think about those other purposes as we think about who's running for office, for example, and how do they get elected. Parties typically play a role in recruiting candidates to run for office. Those local parties typically have played a role historically in encouraging people people who work at the precinct level or volunteer at the election on election day, they're often encouraged to run for local office. So the role that the party plays in recruiting candidates is an important one. And part of the conversation, and I think it was former council member Goldberg who indicated it, part of the problem with running a campaign is not only you need money, but you have to invest an enormous amount of time and energy. And the cost of campaigning, in one sense, pales in comparison to the amount of time that a candidate has to devote to that task. And there, a party typically plays a role in supporting candidates, not only in terms of providing resources, but providing foot soldiers. And parties have historically played a role in terms of getting out the vote. And that's one of the reasons why academics would suggest that voter turnout is normally higher in partisan elections, because that's one of the roles of the party.
Okay. Well, Larry, down at the end.
I have a lot I could say about this, but one thing in particular, we say Ionia, Ypsilanti, and Ann Arbor are the three cities that have partisan elections. But if you want to call it, to widen it to municipalities, every township in Michigan is partisan. And townships are municipalities, too, absolutely. But here's what my point of view on this. We ask a lot of our voters in Michigan, and we perhaps don't even realize the extent of the burden. When you think about how many elected officials we have, where I live in Ann Arbor, I get to vote on almost 100 different positions. You add it all up, you know, from president, vice president, governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, state senator, state representative. Then there's the state board of education, the U of M board of trustees, the MSU board of trustees, U of M board of regents, Wayne State board of governors, Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Probate Court, District Court, Circuit Court, the library board, school board, city council, county board,
community college
board. I almost forgot.
Regents.
Yeah. So all of those things, it adds up. The total, last I counted, I think it was 97. All right. And I could not tell you the names of every one of those people, and I'm the county clerk, So I'm what chance does the regular voter have? So party labels are a labor-saving device for voters, and it basically makes it possible to have to come up with sensible approach to, to say, okay, I'm going to vote for all the Republicans or I'm going to vote for the Democrats except for the ones, you can come up with something, a generalization that is at least defensible. When you see the absence of this, now partisan elections for judges are terrible. I'm not advocating that, but certainly our nonpartisan elections for judges are not something that we can be very proud of. And Irish names are mentioned. It is absolutely a way to get elected judge to be named Fitzgerald or Kavanaugh or Brennan in this state. Wayne County, not too long ago, had four judges named Hathaway in its circuit court, and they didn't get there by, it's not a coincidence that they're – and we had two – at one point our Supreme Court had two justices at the same time, both named Thomas Kavanaugh, Thomas Moore Kavanaugh, Thomas Giles Kavanaugh. They had to go by their middle names because of I don't think judges should be elected, period. And I know that's a controversial view. But there was a movement, a sort of a progressive era thing of, having city managers and nonpartisan city councils elected at large, the idea that cities were – what was wrong with cities was that they were too political and they would have political bosses and things like that and party you think about, people like Mayor Daley or various other cities.
We'll leave it at that.
But the solution to that was to have a scientific, non-political city manager. And somehow that didn't transfer over to county government or township government. It was focused on cities because cities were where their immigrants were and where there were particular things that were could be pointed to as being problems. So I'm as I think I was quoted in the paper saying I think that Ann Arbor on the whole is well governed, and I don't see that this is a fix. We could change. This is one thing the city does have the power to do. We can change to a nonpartisan election. That is within, you know, charter change or whatever to have nonpartisan elections. I don't think that that's necessarily something that we should go with.
Okay. Thank you very much. That doesn't totally answer the question, but there's a lot of good ideas out there. I know a lot of us were just very frustrated with the 4 good candidates we had last year, and we eliminated
If I could say just one more thing.
Sure.
Okay, in 1961, which is just over 50 years ago, we have a 10-member council and mayor, and we had a 10-member council and the mayor were all Republicans.
Oh, no.
So that didn't lead them to say, well, you know, everybody's a Republican, so we should not have partisan elections anymore. So it's just a thought.
Different times. What can we say? On to question number 3. This sounds like it's got your name on it, Joe. What factors play into voter turnout? What changes could be made to improve voter participation? This is a big league thing, so I know you've done some work on this.
Well, actually, I want to borrow some work that was done by one of my students presented at our undergraduate symposium. He did a presentation on addressing voter turnout.
That makes you a good teacher, though. So.
what he did was drew on some Census Bureau data that goes back to 2012, so it's not the most current data. But the Census Bureau asked registered voters, why did you not vote? So the question first was, did you vote or did you not vote? And for those who did not vote, a series of options were offered. So what Mr. Andrew Kochis, my student, did was essentially gather that data, created a spreadsheet, and so on. So if you think about the reasons for people choosing not to vote, what you end up with are things that are absolutely uncontrollable. We just can't control some of these things. And then there are some things that are controllable. So let me share a little bit, some examples of these uncontrollables. Illness, 14%. Out of town, 8%. Conflicting schedules, 19%. Transportation problems, 3%. Bad weather, 1%. I forgot, 4%. Not interested? Well, maybe that's something we can control, but maybe not. That's 16%. That's 65%. That what I just read to you, that's 65% of the people who didn't vote. That's nothing that we can do. There's nothing we can do about that. On the other hand, there were people who said, well, I didn't vote because I had registration problems. The clerk's office gave them a hard time, maybe.
Not Mr. Kessler.
Inconvenient polling places. Again, that's a clerk problem, right? That's something that can be controlled. They weren't interested in the election. Now, maybe that's partisan, nonpartisan. Maybe the candidates weren't of interest. Didn't like candidates. 13% of the people who didn't vote said they didn't like the candidates. Now, again, those are some things that we can control. We need better candidates. We need issues that raise interest among voters who then decide they're going to go to the polls. And we can take care of the registration problems, and we can take care of the polling place problems. But what it boils down to, if you take out the others that are 10%, you're talking about roughly 25% of the people who said they didn't vote gave a reason that we can do something about. And I would just point out that, and it may have been a function of the survey that was before them, nobody said, well, they didn't vote because it was a partisan ballot. Again, that may have been a the product of the choices that were offered. I think if we're thinking about turnout, we have to focus on those things that we can control.
Okay.
I will address another perspective at a later point this evening.
Okay. Talking about control, Larry, are there things there that you think need to be done or reflecting on the clerk's office or stepping out of your clerk suit and just talking about voter turnout?
My clerk suit, I guess. But anyway, I have my view about why it is that people who don't vote, why they don't vote is a little bit. I mean, my it's not that I agree with all the data that was just presented, but my overall perspective on it is a little bit different. I think that oftentimes people don't vote because they're not motivated to. You know, if you're going to be out of town, you can vote absentee. If you're et cetera, if you're housebound, you can do that too. A lot of these things that might be uncontrollable in the very short run can be overcome if you want to. A friend of mine once characterized it as like voting is like picking up a hitchhiker. You know, you're driving along and the hitchhiker's standing there and you're thinking about, should I pick up this hitchhiker or not? And by the time you've had a chance to form a decision, you know, he's a mile behind you. And so it's like the election day is coming along and you know there's an election, and if you don't make a decision that you want to vote in time to vote, you're not going to vote. And I think this goes to issues of people feel like voting has any efficacy, and that obviously varies. People don't understand the system we have. Certainly in Michigan, we have an incredibly complicated system of local and state government, and we don't, I think, make enough of an effort to explain it to people, to explain it, for example, in schools as part of, you know, a sort of civics instruction. I don't think that that's really done very well. Not to say that it's done badly, but that it's not being done enough. Those are all the turnout from election to election varies wildly depending on what's going on, and so people clearly are an audience for the political discussions that are happening and motivating them to vote or not, to make them feel like, that their vote makes a difference, that their vote is important, that they're, that they're needed in some sense. The biggest reform that I would like to see, or the biggest, small structural change, really, that I'd like to see in Michigan, that I think would be achievable, is to move the primary from August, which is in the middle of the summer, where a lot of people are on vacation, to May. There's some pluses and minuses to that. It certainly would work better from an administrative standpoint to have the primary in May.
Okay. The issue, again, is voter turnout improving, increasing. I'd like to hear John's thoughts on this, and your ethicist or specialized teach ethics. Is there an ethical implication for people in this, their duty kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there are political jurisdictions where people are required to vote.
Oh,
Australia,
really?
For instance.
Oh.
They don't come lock you up if you don't. But there's sense, this is an obligation of citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
It's never been particularly popular in the United States, but there are places, and they get higher turnouts.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
In a sense, voting is, for many people, is a habit. If you develop the habit early, you tend to stick with it. And you tend to go a little extra. You feel a little guilty if you, mm-hmm. Didn't vote when you've always been a voter.
Make the extra effort.
So some of it is people reasoning it out. I'm not going to vote this time. I'm not going to show up for the primary because there's nobody to vote for. Or I'm not going to vote in certain races because it's always pick one of one. So I think that there are people who decide election by election, is it worth the trouble? But most of us vote habitually. People are disposed to vote. The people who are disposed to vote, people my age, we have more time on our hands, so we vote. We've always voted. It's easier now. People who have a lot of education are disposed to vote. People who have a lot of income are disposed to vote. So all of those things play into you know, to turn out. And every time you put a little bit of a barrier in the way of somebody turning out, you know, the people with education, money, and old people still show up, and other people get hung up on busy schedules or, you know, get things getting complicated. And lots of places make it easier. My brother's family lives in Washington, and I've seen them sit around a table, you know, with their ballots and the ballot books. Everybody votes. The teenagers are, you know, offering their opinions. And as far as I can tell, elections in Washington are as honest as elections in Michigan. Same thing for Oregon. There are plenty of things you can do to increase turnout if you want to increase turnout. You just have to be willing to do that. And for the most part, if you go back to party ID, Democrats are less likely to show up on election day than Republicans. That's a perfectly good reason if you're a Republican fighting for control to decide, you know, voter fraud is a bigger problem than turnout, and we'll get to turnout next decade. And I think that's what's happened.
Is there a correlation between your rich and old and Republicans? I'm not making any nasty remarks, but
rich, well-educated, old Republicans tend to vote.
Okay.
But so do rich, old, well-educated Democrats.
Okay. Very good. Anybody else on the voter turnout? Larry, please.
Just it's absolutely, in terms of correlation of demographics with voting, the older you are, the more likely you are to vote, the more education you have, the more likely you are to vote. But it's also the longer you've lived at your current address, the more likely you are to vote. Because you know your polling place, you know the issues, you know your ward or precinct, et cetera. And so a lot of the, if you talk about holes in the voting system, ways that people get lost and not vote, is people who move and who are in a new area and they don't know exactly what they're supposed to do. And so, you know, my father, I once remember looking this up, my father didn't vote in the 1964 presidential election because, you know, we had moved a year earlier to Michigan and he just didn't get around to voting. My mother voted, but my father didn't. I was very surprised when I discovered this. My father was a professor of history, and so he certainly had plenty of education. But stability. The more stable you are, the more likely you are to vote. Stable in geographically.
And Larry mentioned the sense of efficacy. That is, will my vote matter? Do people care about people like me? That's hugely correlated with how much money you got and how much education you got.
That too. Yes.
Okay.
Let me just
pipe in on
one of John's comments. If you heard what John was saying, in Washington and Oregon, they mail you the ballot. Yeah. And if you think about it, the ideal is to be sitting around that dining room table talking about what are the issues, a husband and wife and perhaps the family, a conversation, a civic conversation is taking place. So if you think about an ideal, that might be the ideal. Why do we vote by going into a secret hiding place all alone? Nobody else can go in there. So my daughter turned 18 a couple of years ago, and so I encouraged her to go vote. She said, I'll go vote if you go with me, so I went. But, of course, I couldn't go into the voting booth with her.
Right.
So she said to me, so what now? What do I do? And I just go, you'll do it. You'll do okay. She's a college student. But again, the ideal is you want people to be talking about this. And that's partly what Oregon and Washington's approach does. Mm-hmm. You mail that ballot out. And again, that the turnout in those two states, and again, it's still early. They've only had a couple of years of experience. But the turnout is much, much higher. Having said that, both Washington and Oregon had higher voter turnouts anyways.
Yeah. The reason why you can't have someone in the voting booth with you, why you can't show someone your ballot in the voting booth, is because of laws that are designed to inhibit selling your vote.
Okay.
And the idea that that you'd be in there, you'd cast your vote, and you'd hold it up and show it to someone, and they give you your $5.
It was all done before the wrong way, is what we know, and we tried to correct it, probably. Okay, we'll move on to the next question. Just a reminder that there are cards if you'd like to submit a card for a question once we finish our big questions up here. So this one's a big question, literally, but it's about the wards in the city. Ann Arbor City Council wards are drawn in a pie-shaped configuration with the city core serving as the center of the pie. Each of the five wards is represented by two council members being elected on alternating years for two-year terms. How well does this ward system serve this city? Does the configuration of the wards ensure that residents are fairly represented? So, questions of fairness and representation. Who'd like to take that on? John, you look ready.
I'll do that. I actually think that the ward system in Ann Arbor works reasonably well. It's not one that every decade when the lines have to be shifted ends up with just ugly-looking bug squash districts the way you can find, say, in, I don't know, the Michigan, whatever the Michigan district is, that's the Oakland County and Pontiac and snakes around and picks off particular people here and there. I think the question of would we be better off if we had non-pie-shaped things?
Or no wards, possibly, too, is
yeah,
another.
So I think at-large elections actually don't have nearly the sense of accountability. You don't know who to call. They don't know whether you voted for them or not, or even could vote for them. So on the whole, while lots of people use them, they have been used particularly to shut out geographically concentrated communities, particularly black voters in the South. That was the real switch. And so, and over time, the Justice Department has rooted them out. I think it comes up here partly because students think, well, there's no student ward. We've got all these students, some of whom are registered and some of whom vote, but they're spread out and they're chopped up in five pieces, and therefore the students can't get represented. I think districting works in two ways. You could have a district that had a lot of students, and it might well elect a student, you know, to city council who would be the student voice. But since the other eight people, maybe even nine people, plus a mayor, wouldn't be students. They might say, well, that's very nice, but now we're going on to the business of non-students. So you either get representation at the table or you get an effect on governance. And I actually think the governance angle is stronger here than representing particular communities. And I think this works pretty well, that you've got a group of us who live downtown who are represented in each ward. You got some people who live out on the edges of town who are in that ward. The people running for office have got to figure out some balance of, you know, what are we doing for people who live a mile outside of town, and what are we doing for the people who live right downtown? You got a bunch of people doing that. I think it leads to easier compromises, less strident posturing by particular people appealing to their electorate. So I don't think it's particularly broken. But Ann Arbor may be lucky in that regard.
Okay.
This is another example where Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti are different than many of the other cities across the state. Most cities actually use an at-large system. And like John, I probably would argue that that makes campaigning more difficult. It creates problems in terms of accountability. It doesn't tie a representative to a particular neighborhood, but rather you're running on an at-large basis. At-large elections were also part of that good government movement that Larry talked about that brought with it the council manager form of government. So we wanted our cities to be run like a business, so we went to a council manager system. We didn't want the cities to be influenced by partisan politics, so we went to nonpartisan elections. And we didn't want cities to be faced with the same kinds of conflicts between neighborhoods, so we went to at-large elections. But I think the complication of at-large elections is it makes it much more difficult for a candidate to run for office. If you're going to be serious, you got to make a case all across the city. And that's not a problem if you live in a small city. I mean, the city of Ypsilanti, for example, is 3.2 square miles or 3.4 square miles. You could make it around. The mayor does, for example, makes it around the whole city. But this is a different consideration here in a larger community like Ann Arbor or 140 square miles like the city of Detroit.
Yeah, I think that the at-large election system in Detroit was one of the things which damaged Detroit long-term in many ways. It was originally designed to prevent basically to ensure that there was an all-white council by electing them all at large. And it was also, it basically made it impossible, it undermined the whole idea of having a neighborhood in Detroit, since having a neighborhood base meant nothing for a city election. The people elected citywide for city council. They had a 9-member all-at-large city council. You had to be a citywide media figure in order to be elected to anything, to any of the council seats. I think that Ann Arbor is, in my view, pretty well governed, and I don't see that there's a problem that needs to be fixed. I think that having more compact wards would be my aesthetic, I should say, preference, but it's the other thing that we have with the wards of Ann Arbor is as mentioned, you know, every 10 years the wards had to be changed to reflect population shifts, and the changes that have been made have been very modest. So we basically have had the same wards we have now for I think more than 40 years in very large part with very small shifts here and there. And I think that keeping the wards in the same areas with the same numbers so that people have a sense that what they learn from politics they can generalize to the next election and the election after that, that's a good thing. As opposed to, this week we're in the 22nd ward. Well, last week it was the 12th ward. That really is very confusing and disorienting. Ypsilanti had a student ward. They had 5 wards, and they had a student ward, and it was when student participation in elections declined, that ward got very, very few voters, and then they had a very embarrassing situation for the city where someone was running unopposed for that seat, and his campaign manager, his friend, undermined him by running write-in and got enough write-in votes to beat his friend on the ballot. And this was on national talk shows and so forth, and it made Ypsilanti look foolish in the eyes of the whole country. And so the decision was made in the next round of charter revisions to reduce to 3 wards and not have a student ward. The whole system of having 2 members per ward, having a ward, this is very typical on the East Coast. It's a very old-fashioned kind of system. I remember when I went to Ithaca, New York, and you know when I went to grad school, they have exactly the same structure here as Ann Arbor, but that's more common there. Here it's a rare thing. If we were to have 10 wards, there would absolutely be a student ward or more, I think that the representation of different groups having a seat at the table for a group, whether it's an ethnic group or an economic group or students, whatever, can be a good thing that you can when a student comes before the city council in Ann Arbor, they're treated like, wow, who knew there were students here, and who have things to say. In East Lansing, where I grew up, where roughly 3/4 of the adults in East Lansing at the time I was there were MSU students. So a student shows up and immediately there's hostility because students are the enemy. It's sort of like a southern county and, right after the Voting Rights Act, where there's... There was the notion in East Lansing that we should divide the city into 2 wards, a student ward and a non-student ward, and each elect 1 person in addition to the at-large people that they already had, so that at least each side would have someone speak for them on the council.
Interesting idea.
but I think that that in Ann Arbor we have a system that works pretty well.
Okay. We're going into our very last question here, so you people please be thinking about your questions out there. Once again, we'll take them from the microphone as well as from the cards. And Miriam, if you could bring some up to me as we go through this last question, I will be ready to go. Okay, this is up for choice, but this is the big opinion, subjective, I'm sure, but these are the pros. These are the objective professionals who teach government and know government. What are some of the changes that are within our power to make that would improve citizen involvement in local government? You can chip in for a quick answer, and we can go around with lots of them, or we can see. John, what do you think?
Well,
what would improve?
I think we can do some things to get more people to be willing to run for office, okay, so that the ballot has a few more names on it when we show up in August, which is when the real contests are these days. I think that if you think of what are the barriers to running for office, I mean, party affiliation for Republicans seems to be a problem right now, but probably not in the long run. Money is, I think, increasingly a problem, that we're seeing some expensive city council campaigns. And there's already a huge investment in time that goes into this. And I worry that people will think, I'm not willing to write checks that are that large or hit on my friends for donations that are that large for a city council race. And there are public financing options that could make a difference in that. The time commitment for campaigning, that just comes with the territory. And I'm not sure that we can do much about that. Having an August primary means you don't have to campaign for what the presidential candidates are going to do for a year and a half. It's reasonably concentrated, but you got to do it. I think the time commitment of the positions itself may be a barrier. As if this is more than a half-time job, there are a lot of people who can't add that to their busy lives. So cutting back on the duties that come with being a city council person might be one way to do that. And I think it would be nice if there were a little more, given that we don't have much competition between parties, it would be nice to see what we can do to induce some competition within parties while we wait for Republicans to come out of hiding. They're still out there. I think that's an area. The other one we can do something about, I hope, is to provide people with information that will engage them with what's going on in the city. We actually don't have much of that right now. There's not many opportunities to talk about it like this forum. So I think the goal of getting information, providing access to committed people talking seriously about the issues, not the comments section in the Ann Arbor News, but real people who are willing to engage with the issues, and doing that across various communities in town is important. It's been in decline almost everywhere, but Ann Arbor has a better shot of beating that than other places. So that's where I'd put attention.
Thoughts further down? Who'd like to take it up? Joe?
I indicated a little bit earlier that I had some different thoughts on this. I think we're asking the wrong question, quite frankly. The question isn't how do we increase voter turnout. I think the question really is how do we engage the community in the decision-making process? John used the phrase governing and governance a little bit earlier in the conversation, and I think that's what's important to us, not how many people vote, but rather how many people participate in the discussions over issues. As I've traveled across the state and I've worked with local government officials, my argument to them has been you have to be teachers for your residents. You have to help them understand the nature of the issues that we face as a community, as a city. Local government officials have an obligation to do that. I've made the argument again and again. It's interesting. There's another conversation that's taking place this evening. I happened to hear about it this morning on the news. The Ann Arbor engineering office and the street and transportation department is hosting a gathering at Tappan School about how do we fix Geddes Road. And so I would argue, for example, that that's exactly the kind of conversation that we ought to be having to get people involved. You focus on very specific issues that are facing the community. In this case, it's a very narrow one, but you focus on big issues or small issues, but you focus on very specific issues. You make that conversation both educational and informative to make sure that people understand the complexity of issues, but you also listen and you engage them in a conversation about what should we do. I worked for many, many years with the city council in Ypsilanti as they went through budget problems. And we engaged classes of students to do polling, for example, for city council. We hosted focus groups. There are a number of different ways that we can engage the community, engage residents, and we're not going to get tens of thousands of people, but we're going to get people who care very specifically about issues. And it's incumbent upon us to be very aggressive in trying to get people to come out and have a conversation about those issues. So for me, it's not so much about who votes or how many people vote. It's really about how do we engage the community in a conversation about the big issues that we face. And we do face some very difficult ones.
Okay. Larry?
Well, I agree with what's been said. Just a couple of other comments. I think that one of the little talked about phenomena of the last 40 years has been the shortage of people willing to run for office, and it started following Watergate, I think, when people were turned off of the idea of public service, and they had I think that the whole Watergate scandal did tremendous damage to American civic life, and it went from when I was in high school and back in the early 70s, and it seemed like there were crowds of ambitious and highly credentialed people running for any office, and it got to the point where both parties, all levels, everywhere, recruiting candidates was something that was very difficult and that required a lot of persuasion sometimes. Another aspect of this was the Ann Arbor has a national reputation that it has developed that is not necessarily mythical, but certainly is something that gets people have the idea. You go out to Nevada or Iowa or whatever, and you ask people about Ann Arbor, and they say, "Oh yeah, it's a really liberal place." This is sort of affects who moves here, who moves away from here. And I have a friend who is a Republican who worked for the Republican National Committee in Washington. And he moved to Ann Arbor and with his family, and he moved to Ann Arbor because he knew what kind of a place it was, in real life, and wanted to live here, and had an opportunity here. So he moved here, and he thought he would get involved in politics. He would go and he'd go to the local Republican Party and join up and get involved in Republican politics. And he discovered that all the Republicans he went to these meetings, and they all hate Ann Arbor and talked about how Ann Arbor was this hellhole, this horrible place. And he said, "I'm a Republican. I don't hate Ann Arbor. I mean, but it was he found very you can't run for city council talking about what a terrible place why I made such a bad decision to move here." So that's part of the partisan problem. And then the third thing is. It's mentioned that that the whole issue of raising campaign money is a barrier to entry for candidates, for getting more candidates involved. My position, which I know is people oftentimes shout me down when I say this, but I think that money is enormously overrated as an independent force in electoral politics. Let me say that again. Money is enormously overrated as an independent force in electoral politics. I think that a corrupt interest can find that it's a lot easier to buy a politician than buy an election.
Okay. Very, very good. You'll have more chances, and then concluding at the end, if you'd like to say more than that. Now, we are going to have questions. I have questions in hand, and I will go to those. I would like to start with a written question, but if any of you have a question, if you just stand up to the microphone, and I will get you shortly. I'm going to ask this one first, and we'll line you up and alternate. Here's a quick question, and if you could quickly answer it. Okay, so partisan elections are not the issue, but in Ann Arbor, currently overwhelmingly Democratic, why can't we move more candidates forward from the primary? Perhaps all candidates who win a minimum percent, I think it's percent, or maybe it's minimum number, could be either one, of votes move to the general election. Larry, you're an official. Is this a possibility, or just quick answers?
Yeah, the quick answer to that is that no, that's not possible under Michigan law. If to achieve that kind of a result, where let's say the top two finishers in the primary were to move forward to November, would require the election to be nonpartisan. You couldn't do that with a partisan election in Michigan under current law.
Okay. Do either of you gentlemen wish to speak to that? John? Okay. First speaker there, please, your question.
My question, I'd like to refer to Larry's comment about Republicans in Ann Arbor not willing to hold their nose and file as Democratic candidates. That happened in Siler Township, which had been a solidly Republican. I lived out there myself once, and John, my friend, who was, as I was, a grad student at that time, when a Democrat couldn't be elected dog catcher in Siler Township, and we organized the best campaign, and we were able to get 600 votes. We figured that the Republicans were winning with 500 votes. We got 600 votes, but the Republicans got 700 votes. So that's how solid a Republican Siler Township was. But the worm turned eventually. And the Democrats, some of my good friends, Democrats, were able to form a list of candidates and capture control of the Siler Township Board, largely because of Democratic change. Okay, 30 seconds.
Yeah, is there
so
a question?
So why is it Democratic change and, of course, rescheduling the elections to November? Now, why is it that the Republicans can hold their nose in Siler Township and regain control of the Siler Township Board from the Democrats, and they can't do it in Ann Arbor?
Thank you. Okay, question. Anyone like to speak to that? John, you ready?
You could probably draw a couple of Republican districts in town going back to redistricting. I haven't looked at the map, but I imagine if you turned redistricting over to the City Republican Party, they could, you know, find a way to do it. I think Larry's point earlier, this place used to be all Republicans. Now it's all Democrats. One wants to be careful in altering basic institutional structures to solve, you know, a short-run problem. You know, in 20 years, if we haven't elected a Republican, maybe it's time to do something else. But I think it requires Republicans in town to do some organizing. You look at the presidential vote, you look at the gubernatorial vote, there are people who vote Republican. I think it's, you know, for the time being, it's up to them to get their act organized.
Okay. There was also a time when Siler Township was significantly more Democratic than Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor never voted for FDR in four elections. Siler Township did.
Times change.
Okay. Joe, you on that or not?
Nope.
Okay, here we have a question, and I apologize to any of these writers. My reading might be worse than your writing, but anyhow. It's been claimed that party labels help, but it seems that with the most contentious issues City Council is dealing with, for example, development, transit, environments, votes do not fall along party lines. There is one non-Democrat on council, but these votes always come out 6-5. How does the label matter?
I think that when you only have one party running candidates, the label matters less. And so what you have is, you know, sub-parties that form. And if you pay a lot of attention, you can maybe figure out what do the sub-parties stand for. Or you know what Democrats stand for. You know what Republicans stand for. But what about these Democrats versus those Democrats? You got to dig that out. Most of us don't go to the trouble. And it's a kind of new set of words and signals that we're not used to. And as a result, these people have differences in opinions.
Oh, yes.
But is it enough to generate, you know, electoral politics of an interesting sort? It doesn't work as well as party labels do. I mean, I don't know what percentage of people pull the straight ticket Republican or Democrat, but it's very high. That's a sign that, on the whole, they go in there with that mindset. They can go pull a few things back if they want to vote for the other party. We don't have that opportunity now for, you know, this kind of Democrat versus that kind of Democrat. If we did, people would probably vote straight those versions. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a sign that we don't have good signals about what does this mean? And is it all about the mayor, or is it all about development, or is it all about something else?
The issue.
Doesn't help.
My first teaching position was down in Kentucky from 1972 to 1985. And when I got down there, I discovered that, first of all, I had to register in a party. Growing up in Michigan, of course, you didn't have to do that. But when you get down to Kentucky, you have to register in a party. And as a budding political scientist, as I began to study that phenomena, as it turned out, in the early 70s, 90% of the voters were Democrat. But there were fierce battles within the Democratic Party. And it was an urban versus rural split. I mean, you had Louisville and Lexington and Owensboro and northern Kentucky that were urban Democrats. And then you had the rest of the state that was rural. And the factional battles were fought at the primary election. Whoever won that primary election, the faction that won that primary election, went on to win the general election offices. And in some ways, that same kind of thing as I've begun to think a little bit about Ann Arbor now that I've moved over this way, I think you've got some splits, and that's very common. Political scientists have looked at those intra-party divisions for a long period of time, and I suspect that that's what's going on within the Democratic Party here in Ann Arbor. But I admit to being a newcomer to the community.
Yeah, the many states, Michigan is one of the few that doesn't have this, but have the possibility of having local parties within, for example, in a village or a city, there might be the slow growth party versus the pro-development party or something like that. That's not allowed in Michigan. But the more you have one party dominating, the more likely it'll break up into factions. So that's perfectly human nature.
But it would be nice if the factions had names that the rest of us could learn to live with.
Which is why we like the names to begin with.
I mean, years ago, we had a human rights party in town. They actually elected a few people.
Yes.
And they threw some monkey wrenches in things. Politics worked then the way it's supposed to work until the state shut down our single transferable vote after it worked the way it's supposed to.
Do any of you have numbers or percentages on people that do vote straight party tickets?
We do have those numbers. I can't quote them off the top of my head, and it is a large portion of.
Oh, it is. Okay.
But basically, the way that it works is when you have your paper ballot, In a partisan election, at the top of the ballot is the straight party section, and you can mark a party there, which all that does is it sets up a default so that if there's offices, if you leave the rest of your ballot blank, that what that means is your partisan votes will all go to the party you indicated in the straight party section. But you can then go down and vote for different parties if you want on the for the individual candidates. But it will.
All we
have statistics on is the number of people who voted for each party as a straight party ticket, and it's a. I think it's over half. I think it had been falling. Again, these statistics are not consistent everywhere because not every voting system provides them. But my understanding is that percentage had been falling until I think in the 90s, and it's risen since. But I'm not. I can't cite chapter and verse on that. It's still. It's a very substantial part, and even if. I believe that even if the voters didn't have the opportunity to choose the straight party option, that as for example, there's some legislation to take that off the ballot at various times, that people would still go down and vote for their party's candidates all the way down the ballot. It wouldn't really make that much difference.
Okay, thank you.
There tends to be a considerable fall off usually from the partisan part of the ballot to the nonpartisan part of the ballot, and. That might transfer to city elections. I don't know. Haven't looked at the data, but my guess is it would. And that's, again, a signal that you know what party means, and after that it gets kind of fuzzy, and then if you haven't been paying attention, you figure, I'll give it a pass.
Okay. Our next questioner, please.
Yeah. I have a – do you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question regarding the setup of the ballot stations. When you actually go and vote, you fill out your ballot, and then you insert it into a machine. And there used to be a screen around this machine where you inserted your ballot into the machine, and the screen basically facilitated that you had a secret vote because nobody could really see your ballot while you were inserting it into the machine, and the screen vanished. At least two election cycles ago. And I had it happen twice that my ballot came out. I inserted it, and it's in a kind of a folder. You insert it, it's being drawn in, and it was spit out twice in two different elections. It was in plain sight for everybody who was queuing to insert their ballot. And I wonder, the removal of the screen, was this a new state law that demanded to remove the screen, or is this just something and Arbor decided and it could be easily fixed?
Okay. She's talking about the physical voting machine. I didn't completely understand that there was a screen around it and that spit it back.
Yeah.
Larry.
What we have the standard tabulators that the ballots are fed into. And that count the ballots and store the ballots until the end of the election day. The Ann Arbor was forced to change to a different kind of tabulator a few years ago. As far as the screening, again, that's up to the individual precinct and the city township clerks. But the goal is that nobody's ballot should be visible. And if that's not happening, you should complain about it. Okay.
I mean, it would be so easy to put up the screen. I don't understand why the screen cannot be there.
Well, I apologize that was not done. I was, the goal should be to have a completely secret ballot that no one can see your ballot, regardless of whether it gets spit out or not.
Okay. Anybody else speak to that? Okay, a question here. Can the city of Ann Arbor, can the city of Ann Arbor devote funds to the promotion of elections? This is one of the things that we kind of talked about, or at least issues engagement. Can we then get the word out reliably from nonpartisan advocates of voter turnout, like you, like something itself. In other words, can the city basically promote elections? Can we thus get the word out reliably from nonpartisan advocates of voter turnout? Oh, like the government itself. I don't think the government itself is nonpartisan, but the league is, of course. Anyhow, the concept there, John,
yeah, I think
I messed it up. I'm sorry.
The city government could clearly allocate some funds to trying to increase turnout in a variety of ways. I wouldn't want the city to be, you know, we're going to tell you what to think about the election this time around.
Right.
They could, you know, encourage other people to do that or spend some money to put on forums in which mm-hmm. people are encouraged to do that. A variety of things, you know, that the city could do and maybe should do, but they shouldn't get into the, we don't need a Pravda of Ann Arbor.
Should it be the city or should it be parties? Do you think that's a function of the parties that they could do that well? Or
Certainly they're better positioned to do it than the city in terms of what
finances or position.
They have limited resources. I don't know that the city ought to be slipping them checks. But as I say, there are ways to have citizens put money into elections that might well do this. No substitute for having a couple of businesses and other things in town that, you know, are in the business of informing us about what's going on. And we've lost a lot.
Okay. Good idea. Good question. Others of you?
I should just say that the city is required to promote the election and that the city is required to put ads in the paper announcing the election and the registration deadline and so forth. And so it would be impartial, nonpartisan ways, for the city to the city or certainly, groups like the League to promote that there's an election to I know that in some places they have some kind of election festival almost to promote interest in the election, to let people know that there's an election going on. And I should say that, you know, I have been, a registered voter since 1973, and I have in my life that I know of missed one election I was eligible for. It was a school board election when I was in grad school. And if I had known about it, I would have voted, but I didn't know about it.
I mean, you could go to the list of reasons people gave for not voting and ask, is there anything the city could do about that? Is there anything the parties can do about that? The league can do about that? That's where I'd start.
Yeah. Another project. You're out there teaching. That's good. Yes, sir, your question, please.
Thank you. I have a question that some of the discussion raised in my mind, and it touches an area that I'm very much interested in. And the question is, what flexibility do cities have in terms of the ability to change their voting system under state law?
Very little.
None.
Yeah.
It's not quite the answer you were hoping for. You said very little, Larry.
It wasn't a question of the answer I was looking for. I wanted to know the situation because obviously I don't try to go to council members and suggest using a different voting system here.
Yeah, okay. Well, it depends what you mean by voting system, in general, as far as making, large departures from, like first past the post and things like that, the city does not have any ability to do that. There was, the election back in the 70s when there was, when the city used ranked choice voting for one election for mayor and subsequently repealed it. The city could not do that today under state election law.
The city could, though, go to a nonpartisan election, could change the charter. The city could change the charter to go to an at-large election. So if you think about those as structural arrangements related to voting, that is within the authority of the residents or the voters of the city to change the charter.
Or to go through our state representatives, then? Is there initiatives that we could...
Right, it would take,
I mean, I know it would be big, but I'm... Yeah. Okay, another question here. Again, apologies. Turnout is higher in November on even years. Shouldn't we have the meaningful council elections in November? If it means going nonpartisan, why isn't this better? So turnout higher in November on even years. Shouldn't we have the meaningful council... Possibly, we do have elections every year.
Right.
And he's the idea here of this questioner is even years. So, go ahead, John.
Myself, I'd like 2-year terms. We could have 4-year terms, but 2-year terms does, you know, keep elected officials on a bit of a leash that's attached to their constituents. I think that's fine. We could, you know, dump partisanship and move to nonpartisanship and probably get some turnout increases. I think you pay a price on that. Reasonable people would disagree about how you trade that off. I've been pretty clear. I'll take the partisan side of it, but I understand the turnout would matter particularly for students, because students are hard to get registered, get elected, organize,
and then they
and then do it in August. So I think students would probably be much more active in the election, particularly a presidential election, that they do pay attention to. So we'd get some gains.
Well, we have our bigger elections in those years, presidential every 4, the other what we call the large general in every 2. So,
but I still think you'd have a drop-off of going from the partisan races to the nonpartisan races at that point. And I don't know whether overall turnout would probably be higher, but not by as much as you might think.
Right. Larry's story earlier about the Ypsilanti election, where the write-in candidate won with 104 votes or something like that. Students tended not to vote in Ypsilanti, even though they had a student ward. And that was one of the reasons for the charter change over there. I've talked with people here in Ann Arbor who would argue that students didn't vote when the election was held in April, and they don't vote when the primary is held in August because they're not around, and they vote in November, but chances are they don't go all the way down to the bottom of the ballot anyways. And the change in the state law requiring the voter registration address to match the address of the insurer is also a problem, because it eliminates the possibility of U of M students who are insured by their parents of registering here in Ann Arbor anyways. So, again, I'm not sure that we would get a whole lot more students voting if, in fact, we created a student ward or we went to a nonpartisan election.
Right. Well, I think the change in the driver's license thing was tremendously overrated, and it did not affect student voting in East Lansing. And it wasn't the but that's probably an argument for another time. But but having the existence of a student ward doesn't guarantee that there'll be student turnout. Absolutely, and certainly EMU Ypsilanti proved that.
Okay, we have 2 questioners standing and waiting, and I'd like to try to do those 2 questioners and say don't line up after that, okay, unless you want to ask it in the hallways. But yes, sir, we'd like to hear from you.
Professor Chamberlain indicated that the August primary in Ann Arbor is bad news, but he said there's nothing you could do about that. And I agree, it's bad news. We had a 21% turnout for the last mayoral election, and if that had been evenly split, you'd realize that it was a disaster. There would be hardly any indication you had a real voter sentiment. So my question for you, is it true that there's nothing that can be done about it? Isn't it true that you can eliminate the August primary if you go to a nonpartisan election?
Yes. Well,
that's what Traverse City.
I don't know how you decide who gets on the final ballot. Larry probably knows. Is there some hurdle you have to get over to get on the November ballot, or you just start collecting signatures?
Well, you set up a petition
and then we have
like
11
Traverse
people
City's
running for mayor with plurality rule, and that's crazy.
Does that finish your question? And then go ahead, Larry.
It would be an option. Most cities that have nonpartisan elections do have a nonpartisan primary, which is also in August, to narrow down the number of people running. But it is possible. Not every city has a provision for a primary, so it is possible to do it the way we do it with a school board. The school board has no primaries. Everybody who files shows up on the ballot in November, that is within the city's purview. If that was the choice of of how to structure things. Yes.
For example, that's how Traverse City does it.
And that would have to be initiated in City Council then? Or
well, it could be done. Basically, it would have to be a charter change which would be voted on citywide, and it could be initiated either by petition or by the City Council.
I'm not sure, however, that it would solve the problem that I think you're pointing to, because if you have 6 or 8 names on the general election ballot, you're going to fragment the vote even further.
But you're going to decide it when you have half of the voters turning out, rather than an election where you only have 21% of the registered voters.
But assume that you have 40% of the voters turning out, and you divide that 40% vote into 10 different candidates.
But right now you're doing the same thing in the primary, because that's the only election that counts in Ann Arbor, and you have this miserable turnout.
Right.
Okay.
But again, to repeat what Joe pointed out earlier, the 21% is a misleadingly low number, because the base is inflated with Deadwood.
Yeah. Okay, you, sir, are the one. Of the last, or
hopefully it's an interesting question for everybody. So it's being claimed by the panel, and you seem to be very much of a like mind in this, that Ann Arbor has good governance. And I have to say, although I have a 100% perfect Democratic voting record, that I don't really see things that way. And my question to you is, do you think that we have good governance when some very basic city services are not actually being delivered to the standard that they need to be? For example, the national gold standard for emergency medical response is you can get someone within 4 minutes 90% of the time, and we can't do that. And say 3 minutes if you have an emergency to get a police car to your door, but we only have 5 to 6 patrol cars on patrol at any shift in the entire city of 21 miles, square miles, or our potholed roads, or the $600 million of debt that we've run up in the last 15 years, or the sewer problem, the sewers don't work for many people in town, or the water pollution that's toxically polluting underneath half our city and spreading without control. So, I mean, do you really think we have good governance? I mean, considering those specific issues that are very basic to good governance in a city our
size.
Okay.
Your question is good. Do we have good governance? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can certainly acknowledge all the things that you just that you described, and the governance of Ann Arbor can certainly is subject to criticism. Perhaps I have a lower standard of for that. It's not perfect. But when I look at cities where governance has been a problem, it's not as I think that the Ann Arbor is better governed than most other cities in Michigan, in my opinion. But absolutely, there's a long time condescension match, you could call it, that the county looks down on the city as being poorly run, and the city looks down on the county as being poorly run, and you know they're either both right or they're both wrong. But the contention that there's a big problem in the governance of the city has not been borne out. I think that there a lot of the issues that there formerly were with the city have been addressed and resolved. Not everything, but it is the things that speaking as when I was a county commissioner, the things that I would have pointed out as city problems. Most of those things from 15 years ago are no longer problems. So now there's new problems, and now there's new issues, things that maybe have been neglected. I certainly agree with that, but I think that in the opinion of most Ann Arborites, the city is relatively well governed.
Okay,
I would just make a quick comment. Each of the issues to which you speak are connected in part to resource constraints. And so we trade off. We want to put more money into infrastructure, and that means we have one fewer police officer out on the street. We want to upgrade our EMS response time, which means we got to take money out of the Public Works Department. There are trade-offs that have to be made, and that's one of the difficult challenges associated with governing. And you know, part of the problem and part of what we're talking about here is how do you engage the community in that conversation about trade-offs? How do you engage the community in dealing with the complexity of the challenges that we face?
But what about the $50 million waste of building the garage next to this facility here? It was premature. Maybe in 10 years at a different time we need it. Or what about the $40 million on the city court building?
Okay, thank you very much. I think you've asked your question, and we've got, and I'm certain they'd be glad to talk with you. Each of these gentlemen here, we thank you so much for being here. Is there any final, succinct answer? You figured it out after sitting together here tonight that this will solve the problem. If there's anything you'd like to finish to say.
I just made my final comment.
You did very well. Thank you.
Can
Joe?
I ask a quick question? What has happened to Wolverine Girls State and Wolverine Boys State? Because I used to speak to them. I did it 7 years back in the 60s, and I haven't heard of them for a long time.
Good question.
And how much civics is being taught in the schools?
That's a very good question.
It's a question we will try to find an answer to, but it's a good one. Thank you, Mary, very, very much. John, do you have anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
No, although I will say this last question about, you know, and I think Joe's right, you got a limited amount of money. You can spend it on different things. Ann Arbor was lucky to get through the recession whole. Lots of cities in the state didn't. And I think if our electoral system were a little more robust, we'd have more conversation that was exactly about that instead of crypto stuff about what does get talked about. So I don't know how to fix that. This is pretty clear. The state won't let us fix it in some ways, and other things aren't working well. But I would like to have more discourse at the city council level and in campaigns about exactly those questions.
Or forums just like this. We keep it going. Yes, thank you very much, everybody here, for your interest. You're wonderful. Special thanks to the library and to the league, and a big hand, as we had, for our people. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It was great.